Well, hello and welcome to the Mariners Library with me, Chris Stanmore-Major. And in this episode, we're continuing the book The Venturesome Voyages of Captain Voss by Captain J.C. Voss. We're on the first chapter, and this is the second part of the reading. And if you haven't already, please consider going over to patreon.com/themariner, and there for $5 a month you can help support this podcast and keep the information contained within these fantastic books easily available for the next generation. Now on with the story. Chapter 1. £7 million, a chance of a lifetime. My seafaring life commenced in the year 1877, when I was quite a young man, and was spent, up to the time I sailed in the Zora, in large sailing vessels, during which period I have filled all sorts of positions, from deck boy up to master. Throughout all those years I would certainly not have believed that a vessel so small as the Zora could live through a heavy gale at sea, and naturally enough should not have thought of attempting a long sea voyage in any small craft, had it not been for a gentleman whose name was George Hafner, an American citizen. In the summer of 1897, when I was sitting comfortably in an easy chair in the Queen's Hotel, Victoria, British Columbia, a gentleman stepped up to me saying, "Are you Captain Voss?" I replied in the affirmative. He then introduced himself as Mr. Hafner, handing me at the same time a letter saying that it was from an old friend of mine whose death had taken place at sea just 14 days previously and with whom he had stayed during his last moments. The letter ran as follows. "Dear friend, John, you will be surprised to learn that I am now lying on my deathbed. Yes, dear friend, we are at present a long way out on the Pacific Ocean, and I shall never be able to see land any more, but shall be buried at sea like a dog, and the Pacific Ocean will be my grave. The bearer of this note is Mr. George Hafner, who knows the position where the great treasure lies on Cocos Island. Believe in him, and he will make you a rich man. Excuse my short note because I am very weak. Kindly remember me to all my old friends, and believe me. Your dying friend, Jim Dempster." About 5 months previous to this meeting with Hafner, a Victoria sealing schooner of about 75 tons had been chartered by several enterprising men of Victoria, of whom Dempster was one, for the purpose of sailing down to Cocos Island to make a search for the great treasure supposed to be buried on that island. Hafner was in possession of a permit issued by the Costa Rica government to secure the treasure if found by him, and he stated that when his sealing schooner, called the Aurora, arrived at Cocos Island, he had already been on the island for 9 months, during which time he had vigorously searched for the treasure and had located the same. Surprised at this, I asked him dubiously why he had not taken the treasure back to Victoria in the Aurora. He explained that, having arrived at Cocos Island by the Costa Rica supply boat, which undertakes a trip every 6 months to supply the guard on the island with provisions, he met the crew of the Aurora. Not knowing anything of their intentions, and besides not liking the captain, he did not feel disposed to disclose his secret as to where the treasure was buried. He continued, "Meanwhile, the crew of the Aurora worked with all their might and made excavations in many places without, however, having the slightest success. Finally, the men got tired and dissatisfied at having come on a wild goose chase. Besides, their provisions ran short, so they were compelled to return to Victoria, giving me a passage at the same time. Shortly after our departure from Cocos Island, Dempster became ill, and as a passenger on board I volunteered to nurse him. I did all I possibly could for him, but he grew worse and worse, so that it was soon plain to me that he would shortly succumb. Not knowing anybody in Victoria, and not being a sailor myself, I thought of getting in touch with a responsible person in Victoria who would join me on an expedition to Cocos Island to bring away the treasure. So I decided to confide the news that I had found the treasure to Dempster. Greatly surprised at this, he almost gained new life, but realized later that his end was near and that he himself could not profit by my communication. I then asked Dempster to give me the name of a reliable man in Victoria who would be in a position to procure for me a suitable vessel and crew with which to sail to Cocos Island and carry off the treasure. He mentioned your name and wrote the letter which I have just handed to you. Because I had found, from the day I first met Dempster on Cocos Island till he died, that he was a straightforward and reliable man, I have decided to place confidence in you. I now ask, can you and will you procure for me a vessel and fit her out properly, sail with me to Cocos Island and assist me to put the treasure on board and take it to Victoria. As compensation, I offer you 1/3 of whatever we may secure of the treasure, which would be the same as my own share, as we have to hand over 1/3 to the Costa Rica government. To my query, Hafner then explained that the treasure was valued at over £7 million, so that each share would amount to, say, £2,333,000, and as it had been said that the treasure consisted principally of gold ingots, the total quantity of this gold would weigh approximately 50 tons and measure roughly 100 cubic feet. Turning these gigantic figures over in my mind, my brain almost became dizzy. At last, I thought to myself, your poor old daddy's words will come true. He often told me in a joking way, when you grow up, John, I shall make a millionaire of you. When I was about 16 years of age and reminded him of his promise, he thought it would cost too much money and recommended me to go out into the world and hustle for the million myself. He told me that if I kept on hustling well and hard, I would certainly succeed in becoming a millionaire. Of course, like a good son, I took my father's advice, went to sea, and from then till the day I met Hafner, I had been hustling up and down and all around the world, but never had managed to commence becoming a millionaire, even in Japanese yen. And as I was then already past 40 years of age, I had almost lost confidence in my father's prophecy when meeting Hafner. This gentleman explained to me in detail where the treasure was buried and showed me a chart of the island with cross bearings marked on it to give the position. All that Hafner said appeared to me so simple and straightforward that I certainly arrived at the conclusion that my fortune was made and that I should in reality become a millionaire, not only in cents or dollars, but in pounds sterling, and a double header at that. What a grand feeling came over me. A poor man, firmly believing that I would be soon the possessor of millions of money, the thought of which was with me day and night. I dreamt the first night after meeting Hafner that we were both standing on Cocos Island near a large cave out of which glittering gold and sparkling diamonds were shining invitingly. But, to cut a long story short, I really felt the happiest man in the wide world and did not fail to have a good time in advance at the prospect of becoming a real millionaire. In the meantime, I was looking round for a suitable vessel, and I found a 100-ton schooner. Hafner, however, did not quite approve of it, thinking it was not really fit to carry such a valuable cargo, and one fine day said the vessel was unsuitable, but that he had luckily met Admiral Pallister of the Northwest British Squadron, who had agreed to make a trip to Cocos Island and, under the guidance of Hafner, to bring the treasure to Victoria in his flagship, the Imperieuse. This news struck me like a thunderbolt. Well, in that case, I said, I suppose I'm out of it. Very sorry indeed, he replied, but I am sure you understand my position. In order to secure the treasure with safety, I must have a good ship and, what is more essential, protection, neither of which you can afford me. And by placing myself in the hands of Admiral Pallister, I shall have both. I saw that Hafner was right, and probably should have done the same had I been in his position. However, I felt truly miserable. I felt as if I had lost my mental balance. All the castles I had already built in the air had vanished with this sudden blow, and what was worse, I had spent quite a little of my savings so that the tide of my banking account was at a low ebb. After leaving Hafner, I would not at first believe his story, that a British man of war should undertake such an expedition. But it proved to be true when Admiral Pallister left Esquimote Harbour in his flagship Imperieuse with Hafner on board and escorted by a cruiser for the south. So I thought to myself, instead of being on the road to fortune, I have to hustle again and harder than ever before. I solemnly vowed that I would never again build castles in the air or have a good time and spend money in advance on the strength of a promise of good prospects, but would wait until I actually had the cash in hand. Chapter 2. In a Sloop on the High Seas. After a lapse of about 3 months following the departure of the two vessels from Esquimalt Harbour, during which time I had been anxiously waiting for news of their trip, I received, to my great surprise and joy, the following letter from Hafner. Dear friend, Voss, I have to admit that I feel very sorry indeed at not having accepted your advice with regard to the 100-ton schooner and the advantage of your company for a trip to Cocos Island, but you know that at the time I felt confident that it was to my advantage to avail myself of the man of war. Sorry to say the trip turned out a complete failure, inasmuch as I should never have been able to make use of the treasure after having placed it on board the Imperieuse. During the voyage down, an officer one day questioned me about the treasure and asked me whether I knew what would be done with it after it was on board, and when I said, "It will be taken to Victoria," he replied that a treasure such as that, when shipped on a British man of war, would have to be handed over by the Admiral to the British government, who would in turn hand it back to the rightful owner, i.e. the Peruvian government. After carefully considering the officer's statement, I made up my mind that the treasure should not be shipped on board this vessel, in fact, that it should not be found with my help. On our arrival at the island, work was at once commenced under my leadership, and I kept the men at a safe distance from the correct spot. After continually shifting the men about for a fortnight, they got tired, and the officers who were watching them also grew weary. Of course, great excitement prevailed the whole time, and everybody expected to see gold bricks and diamonds flying about by the shovelful. But gradually, disappointment set in, when nothing came to light after all the hard labour. The officer then told me that I must have made a mistake in the location, which I reluctantly admitted, remarking at the same time that I really did not know of any other place where it might be. The good-natured officer looked at me with a smile and said that he would have to report my statement to the commander. That night, when I went on board, I expected a severe calling down, but nothing happened. However, the next morning, we put to sea again and made for Acapulco, where I was put on shore and where I am staying at the present time. I certainly must give the British credit for being good-natured people, as they took it all in good part. If I had played the same trick on Americans, I am sure that they would have first keel-hauled me, then hanged me at the main yard, and then put 12 bullets through me, after which they would finally have drowned me to make sure I was dead. Now, dear friend, I herewith repeat the offer made a short while ago in Victoria. Come down here as quickly as possible with any kind of vessel you consider fit, and we will then sail to Cocos Island, secure the treasure, and put on board as much of it as the vessel will safely carry. If we cannot bring off the whole lot at once, we will leave the rest on the island for a second voyage, as it will be quite safe where it lies now. Kindly let me hear from you as soon as possible, care of the GPO, Acapulco, Mexico. Yours very truly, G. Hafner. Needless to say, the contents of this letter excited me not a little. The same feeling of having now the opportunity of becoming a millionaire took possession of me, and my heart leaped with joy. However, I did not again build castles in the air, nor did I have a good time in advance, but instead I carefully thought the matter over and tried to arrange things as well as possible. My finances were very low, so that it was out of the question to procure a large vessel, and I quickly came to the conclusion that it would be more advisable to start in a small one, especially as I did not want more partners than were absolutely necessary. Furthermore, the season was favourable, it being the month of June, when the weather is generally fine along the Pacific coast of America. I therefore tried to buy a vessel of 30 or 40 tons. There were, however, no such craft available, and I finally selected a 10-ton sloop called the Zora. Truly, she was a small vessel in which to make a sea trip of some 4,000 miles, but I made up my mind firmly to go in her whatever might happen. There was no alternative, as without money I could not obtain a large boat, so I bought the Zora and fitted her out. She was strongly built of Oregon pine and fitted with a heavy wooden centreboard, had a straight stem and a nice moderately overhanging counter. Her dimensions were length overall 35 feet, length on the waterline 30 feet, beam 12 feet. Her draft, with the centreboard up and about 5 tons of ballast inside of her, was 3 feet 6 inches. Her canvas consisted of mainsail, gaff topsail and jib. When the Zora was fully fitted out, I provisioned her with 200 gallons of fresh water and sufficient food, etc., to last 3 men during 4 months. When everything was on board, the vessel's draft was a trifle over 4 feet. On the 5th of July, 1898, everything was ready for sea. I had engaged 2 friends of mine to sail with me, Mac, who had never been to sea, and Han, who had been a sailor like myself. The following afternoon at 1 o'clock, we cast off our lines and sailed out of Victoria, BC. Having kept our intended cruise secret, we cleared as a pleasure yacht. With a light easterly breeze and all sail set, we left the James Bay boathouse and sailed down the harbour, while hundreds of Victoria inhabitants bade us farewell, waving their hats and handkerchiefs and wishing us bon voyage. Soon after, the wind freshened a little, and in a short while we passed the outer wharf and stood into the Royal Roads, after which we shaped our course for Race Rock, rounding it at 4 o'clock and stood out to the west into the Pacific Ocean. The wind freshened considerably and hauled round to the west, at the same time throwing up a lively choppy sea, which made the little vessel jump about worse than a bucking horse. Han and I, both old seamen and used to large vessels only, which have an entirely different motion to a craft like the Zora, did not feel overly comfortable. But poor Mac, for whom this was the first experience in a sailing boat, was hanging his head over the rail and singing out, "If this thing keeps on jumping about like this much longer, I shall have to throw up my Irish heart, as everything else is already overboard." Seeing the plight he was in, and we other two also feeling rather funny, we decided to stand into Sook Inlet, a very nice little harbour for small vessels about 5 miles west of Race Rock. There we anchored at 7 o'clock. Owing to strong westerly winds, we remained here until the 9th of July, when, at 4 o'clock, with a moderate easterly breeze and a fine clear morning, we made another start. Standing into the straits, the light easterly breeze soon freshened, and early in the afternoon we passed Cape Flattery, which is the farthest point of land, in a northwesterly direction, of the United States of America. Now the deep blue Pacific Ocean lay before us. About 40 miles from Cape Flattery lies Cape Beale, which is the farthest southwesterly point of Vancouver Island. Both promontories are supplied with fine lighthouses and are about 40 miles apart. This region is known among sailors on the Pacific coast as the Seaman's Graveyard, as many a staunch vessel with all her crew has gone down to the bottom there, through the heavy southwesterly gales or through being smashed up against the hard rocks on the Vancouver shore. I shall never forget the night of the 1st of April 1887, when I was second mate of the full-rigged American ship Top Gallant and bound out from the Straits of Juan de Fuca in company and almost side by side with the fine 3-skysail-yard, full-rigged ship St. Stephen, and an American bark whose name has slipped my memory. All 3 ships, under full sail, passed Cape Flattery towards evening, shaping their courses toward the southwest with a fresh easterly breeze. None of the vessels was more than 5 miles outside Cape Flattery when the wind hauled round to the south, with thick and threatening-looking weather. "We are going to have a bad night of it," said our captain. "The wind will most likely haul round into the southwest, and then it will blow hard." "It is blowing pretty hard already," said I. "Shall I take in the 3 royals? "Take in nothing," he replied. "Now is the time to sail, for we must get away from the Vancouver coast as fast as possible before the wind blows from the southwest and the gale falls upon us." The Top Gallant was well up in years, but was still a strong vessel, and everything was in good order and condition, and if ever the ship was sailed, she was sailed that night. Rail and deck were under water, and heavy seas broke over her weather side. At 7 o'clock, the main royal was blown away, after which the 4 and mizzen royals were taken in. "If the wind only continues to blow from the south, for another hour we shall be out of danger," the captain said, but to our sorrow it did not. The wind soon hauled into the southwest, and it blew one of the hardest gales that was ever experienced on the northwest coast of North America. "All hands on deck to shorten sail," the captain shouted. The top gallant sails, the mainsail, and some fore and aft canvas were taken in as quickly as possible, but in spite of our efforts, some of the sails were blown to shreds before they could be secured to the yards. The foresail, lower and upper topsails, and some fore and aft storm sails were left standing, but in spite of the sails being quite new and of the very best material, they were torn to ribbons one after another by the tremendous force of that southwesterly gale. At 11 o'clock, while all hands were engaged on the foreyard arm in saving what was left of the foresail, the lee fore lower topsail sheet parted and knocked one man from the foreyard overboard. "Man overboard!" came the cry all along the yard, and the few pieces left of the foresail having been well secured, all hands rushed down on deck to save the man. Owing to the darkness and the howling and roaring noise of the storm and the breaking seas, the man overboard could neither be heard nor seen, and as the lifeboats of ships were at that time, and still are, worse than useless to be launched in such weather, all the crew got busy throwing ropes and lifebuoys after the man. As luck happened, the man got hold of one rope and was then quickly pulled on board, none the worse for his trying experience. At midnight, the gale was at its height, and as all the sails by this time had been blown away, the good old ship lay in the trough of the seas at the mercy of the elements, drifting gradually towards the Vancouver shore. "We have lost our sails," the captain said, "but if the gale moderates by 8 o'clock in the morning, we shall, by having sailed as we did, have saved the ship, cargo, and crew." Sure enough, Captain Wickberg of the Topgallant was right. We had carried on till the storm had blown all our sails to ribbons, and by doing so had saved the ship, cargo, and crew, for when the gale moderated in the morning and the weather cleared, we found ourselves within 4 miles of the Vancouver shore. New sails were bent on, we continued our voyage, and arrived finally at our destination in safety. The new and fine ship, St. Stephen, with her full crew, captain, his wife and family, and 2 lady passengers, went to the bottom of the sea that night. The bark, which was in our company sailing out of the straits, also went down that awful night. 2 of her men were saved by hanging on to some wreckage when the ship sunk beneath them. In these same waters which have swallowed up so many young and brave seamen, I was now sailing in a 10-ton sloop, and comparing her with the large vessels in which I had up to then been sailing, I almost came to the conclusion I did not care to risk making a 4,000-mile voyage in this tiny craft to Cocos Island for all the money in the world. But after all, I thought, what is life without money? And so, with the Zora under full sail and with an easterly breeze, we sailed hopefully out of the Straits of Juan de Fuca into the Pacific Ocean, shaping our course toward the south. Well, that's all for the Mariner's Library this episode. I hope that you're enjoying the story as much as I'm enjoying reading it for you. If you haven't already, please consider going over to patreon.com/themariner, where for $5 a month, you can help support this podcast. But wherever you are and whatever you're doing, I hope that you're safe and sound, and I look forward to speaking to you in the next one. Cheers.